Hello. I'm so sorry to interrupt. We can't hear you. You're muted.
No, honestly, I'm being honest, man. Unfaithful. Just kidding. Can you hear now? Well, you can't hear all of them. Good. Okay, I got a thumbs up. Thanks.
Yes, thanks.
So you didn't miss anything good. We're moving on to the good stuff. I didn't. What I knew, and I knew this, and was that I it seemed my sponsor told this story, and I thought that's exactly it. He said it seemed to me like God got everyone in a room and said, "I'm going to tell you how to live life, but I'm only going to go through this once." And I came out of the bathroom as everyone was like, "Great," because it just seemed like everyone else knew what was going on. Like in my high school and my school, guys knew how to get girls. People knew how to play sports. People knew how to show up in class. And I just was wandering around, like, what is happening? What am I supposed to do? Who am I supposed to be? And then I drank, and I remember the first time I drank, and I remember thinking, "Oh, dear Lord, baby Jesus, where has this been? Like, where has this stuff been?" Because it did everything I needed it to do. It made me funny, and it made me not on the outside. It put me at the table. It put me in the middle of things. It made me taller. It's a miracle drug. It did everything I wanted. And I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt, I honestly mean this. If I was an alcoholic, I would be drunk right now. Like, I'm not one of those people that was like, "Oh, alcohol was terrible." Alcohol was not terrible. And it probably kept me alive through really horrible years. The problem is I'm alcoholic. That's the problem. So when there are people that can use alcohol as a tool to manage their anxiety or to manage their social, or to manage, that's great. Absolutely do it. The problem for me is that I have this disease. And so the thing that was solving all my problems really quickly became the thing that was causing all my problems. And I didn't understand any of it. I didn't, there's nobody in my family that's an Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nobody that's an alcoholic. I was like on my own in this weird outpost of addiction, like with my whole family looking at me, being like, "What is wrong with that kid?" And what was wrong was a very clear progression of alcoholism. So when I start drinking, I can't stop. Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't align to the DSM-4 or 5 or whatever volume. Like, we have our own definition of what alcoholism is, your hard-earned experience. And that definition boils down to a couple of things. If when I start drinking, I can't stop by the phenomenon of craving, or when I don't want to drink, I fall down drunk. It's pretty easy. It's not, and it's an or. Doesn't have to be both. So I knew from the earliest days of my drinking, when I started drinking, I couldn't stop. I didn't know there was drinking that didn't look like that. The book talks a lot about potential alcoholics, and it seems to draw this model that says, like, you can drink for a long time normally and then cross over into alcoholism. Now, maybe some people have that experience. I don't have any of that experience. There's not a moment. I was 14 years old. There was no like bellying up to the bar after a hard day's work or a couple fingers at the gym and then head to home. Like, none of my drinking was normal, not any of it. And it was all get this stuff in me as quickly as possible. And I hate the taste of it. I hate all of it, but I knew exactly what it was doing for me, which was get it in, get the medicine in, shut the machine down, and let me just be normal. And I did it as often as I could. I instantly started hiding booze in my room. I befriended a young lady whose dad ran a liquor store, and like made her think lots of things. We were going to get married because really what I needed was access to those liquor cabinets. And the other part of the of so the phenomenon of craving was super clear to me. I didn't know it was part of alcoholism. The other part was like falling down drunk. I would wake up in the morning and be like, "Okay, today it's not going to be a weird day." And then by 2:30, I would be hammered, being like, "What the hell happened?" And I always say that, and you can always watch people, and they're like, "Yep." Like, for the record, normal people don't do that. Nobody wakes up and says, "I'm not going to eat turkey sandwiches today." And then by afternoon, it's like slamming six of them. Like, it doesn't happen. Like, it just doesn't happen. But for us, it happens. Like, I'm walking down the street, booze always sounded like a good idea. No matter what the book talks about, not being able to recall with sufficient force the pain and misery of a week or a month ago, and that to me was exactly it. Arrested, I am. My buddy will confirm this. I'm kind of obnoxious on a good day. I'll just be very honest with you. Like, 30 plus years sober, I'm pretty obnoxious on a good day. When I'm drunk, I'm mean and obnoxious, and I'm like 130 pounds, and which means I get the crap beaten out of me all the time. But I'm drinking all the time. Like, I was the guy in the friend group that was like, bro, if you start another fight, we're not coming in. Like, you're on your own. I'd be like, that's cool. I got a knife. Like, that's cool. That'll be fine. So all of that pedaled along. And the other piece of this, which is truthful, and I'm going to get off talking about drinking because I'm sure we all know how to drink. I adopted it as an identity. So I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know how to live. All of a sudden, I knew how to. So I was like, okay, I'm a drunk. I know what parties are. I know what booze is. This is my life. I wore it like a Letterman jacket in my high school. I wore it like an identity. And I read Hunter S. Thompson, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which if you haven't read, it's like I read it exactly the wrong time. And I was like, you can have this as a profession. Like this is like, I'm going to be a Rolling Stone. I don't know what, but like this is, and I built this delusion in my head that was really hard to shake. And one of the toughest parts of alcoholism for me is, and my sponsor laid it out the minute he started working with me, is I will believe things that are true that are completely insane. And I will believe, the difference between a delusion and a lie is I will believe it. I will believe it. I will believe that this is, and so one of the things that I believed was there were two kinds of people in the world, suckers and people like me. And so if you had a problem with me, it was because you couldn't have it. It was because you were criticizing. It's because you were jealous. It was because, so, and that builds this armor around which I can just run into alcoholism with everyone criticizing me, being like, and my life was spinning down into the drain. And I got to a place, a very dark place in the basement of an apartment, completely psycho with weapons hidden around and locks on the doors and curtains drawn and me not knowing whether it was 2 a.m. or 2 p.m. I got into a really dark place, a place dark enough that even I didn't know if it was like, okay, like really, this is like what everyone's trying to be like, because this seems awful. And then I hit a bottom, I split a half gallon of Jim Beam. This is where almost, we were talking about bourbon, with me and two other guys, and I blacked out of a friend's house. And I tried to beat his parents up. Now, in clear defense, they were also minutiae, like they were like small, so it was like, it wasn't like, I wasn't being heroic, it was sort of like, and they called my mom, and they said, come get your drunk kid from our house, and he's not welcome here. And I woke up out of a blackout in the couch on my mom's house. And she was a doctor, and she came out of denial, like a switch got flipped. I mean, she was like, arrests and all these like drama and everything. It was like, ah, that's Chandler being Chandler. And all of a sudden she was like, you're an alcoholic. And here's what's going to happen. You're either going to be homeless today or you're going to go to rehab. But one way or the other, everything changes. Today, everything changes. And I often wondered if I was an alcoholic when I was newly in sobriety because I got sober young. And it was just like, oh, it was a phase, whatever. But that morning I weighed homelessness. Like, I was like, how bad could it be? People do it, right? Like, I don't know. I'm kind of wiry, like, got some hustle. And then I told her everything. And you do not tell your medical professional mother everything. I was in rehab an hour and a half later, and it was a 45-minute drive. Like, she was like, 1 second. I mean, it was nuts. And I went to an inner-city Toledo rehab. Toledo, Ohio. It was the craziest. There was a guy we called Jimmy Two Liver because he was detoxing off a second transplant. And there was a dude in the corner smoking really nice cigarettes. And I was like, what are you in for? And he was like, I'm just evading federal gun charges. Like, I'm not even an alcoholic. They just can't tell me what I'm here. So I'm going to be here a lot. And then a woman died. She came in to the ER and they said, you're going to die in detox or you're going to die if you keep drinking. So you need to decide sort of right now which way you want to go out. We called her the owl because she had these like bangs. And she said, I'd like to die sober. And they said, okay. And so they put her in and she died 2 days later. And I watched her reeling her out. Now I ran into a counselor. I'm a big believer that when the student's ready, the teacher appears. I'm a massive believer of that. I'm also, and this is part of my story, a believer that God will send you teacher after teacher after teacher after teacher after teacher after teacher. And so I had a counselor, and I was sitting there, and I was like, hot stuff, and I had long hair, and I was 19, and I had just gone through DTs, and I was like, everything's going to be fine. And he looked at me one day and he said, I bury kids like you, and I'll bury you. And it doesn't matter to me because I'll come to work the day after. And what I have come to find out, the book talks about frothy emotional appeal. Like, the only thing that works with me is casual indifference. The only thing that works. You cannot beg me to do anything. You cannot cry at my feet for me to do anything. But if you tell me the truth as if it was like, he was telling me like it was Wednesday. Like he was like, you are going to die of this disease. And so at that moment, I was like, I think I want to get sober. And I don't know if anyone else did this. So we did their intake and I filled out what I thought a non-alcoholic was drinking was. And they were like, inpatient rehab, immediate rehab. Like, strict. Like, okay. And so I was like, can I get that thing back? It's time to be honest. And they were like, oh boy. Now, this is sort of where, so I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because what my rehab did, coming back and forth, what my rehab did was it stabilized you physically and then it turned you over to AA. So we get, Billy talked about, we talked a little bit earlier about people having opinions. I got a lot of opinions. So I'm going to offer one now. We talked about rehab, and in some rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's almost like we have an opinion on that. And I want to be crystal clear, like Alcoholics Anonymous does not have an opinion about rehab. To the extent it does, it's that we cooperate with the medical community. So I went to rehab, and when I went to rehab in the inner city of Toledo, there were so many volunteers from Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought one of them was a patient, and I asked, why does she get to keep leaving? I was like, this is an inpatient facility, right? And they were like, Chandler, yeah, sweetheart, you're going to be fine. Like, and so they turned me over to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous in Northern Toledo is doing alive and well, and they did exactly what Alcoholics do. They said the same thing I've heard for 30 years. Get a hunger. Get a job in your home group, get a sponsor, start working steps. That's what they said. They said, this is what Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. And so I went into AA and I had some goals. And the goals were really easy. The goals were everyone in my family knows that I went to rehab. If I drink again, it's gonna be high drama. I don't really wanna have any high drama. I cannot keep a girlfriend. It'd be nice if I could keep a girlfriend. Most of my family hates me at the moment. And I come from very transparent people. Like, it was not like, I wasn't like reading between the lines. Like, they were like, you're kind of crap. And I keep getting beaten up. I'd like the beatings to stop. I'd like the beatings to stop, the family to like, keep a girlfriend, drama dialed down. That's what I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was 19, and I look old now by comparison. Like, I rolled in, like, people were like, is your dad here? Like, I moved to Northern Indiana. Actually, so I live in North Baltimore now. I participate in sort of city AA. But I got sober in small church basements in Northern Indiana, Northeastern Indiana, 7-8 people in drive hours. And when I walked in, they just threw their arms around and were like, we could save you from decades of trauma if we get this right. That was how they didn't see a young kid. They saw an opportunity for someone not to go 10 years. So I got a home group, got a job in my home group, got started work, I did everything. Now, a couple of things. I'm a heck of a self-starter, and I can put on whatever uniform I need to. I was a skater for a while, I was a deadhead for a while, I was a college student for a while. I have a very expensive graduate degree in stream entomology. Like, I can chameleon into whatever you want. And so I chameleoned into, like, I'm going to be an AA guy. I'm an AA guy, so I got a job in my home group, got a sponsor, I started working steps, did the whole thing. And, the problem is, and this is a pretty big, turns out it's a pretty big problem, is what I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous with is, this is going to save my life. I didn't come in saying, like, my life depends on this. What I came in with was, can you make my life a little better? Is that cool? Right? And so I went to a bunch of meetings, and I got really involved, and I started some steps, and I worked this. I went back to school. I went to Columbus, Ohio. And I'm gonna foreshadow, like, I'm heading into like some dark waters of like long term sober, completely miserable. And I've heard this story a lot, and I've heard it from a lot of people. And often what they try to say is, well, the message just wasn't right. That I was going to crappy meetings. And I gotta be honest, I was an hour and a half from where AA started. Like, the message was clear, it was great. My sponsor traced his lineage back to a meeting in Cleveland that purports to be the longest continuous meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, it was not about the message for me. It was about what I was looking for. And so I walked in, and what I walked in with was like the drama to dial it down. And they said, do these steps. And I started to walk through the steps until I got to step 9. And I was like, because like step 1, they were like, are you alcoholic? I was like, yeah, I went through that. Yeah. And they said, step 2, do you believe in God? And I was like, yes. And the part that I didn't say was, I hate him, and I'm pretty convinced he hates me. But if you say that in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, stuff starts to go wild. like the people that don't want to hear that don't want to talk to you, and the people that do want to hear it want to talk to you too much, right? Like, we can fix that. And I just kept that down. They said, take the third step. I was like, get on my knees and say a prayer. I've been lying to people my whole life. Like, and I'm going to lie right through this. Turn your will and your life over. I was like, to a dude with a gray beard on a throne with a sharp stick and a bad sense of humor that keeps screwing my life up. Yeah, let me turn that over. Let me give that away. And then they said, do a 4-step. And I'm like a journaler. That was easy. I did a bunch of journaling. And then they said, do a 5-step. And it had sex in it. And so I was like, done. Like, sign me up. And then they said, you know, do a 5-step. And I was like, free therapy, having some guy sit across, listen to me whine about my problems for hours on end. I could do that. And no one understands 6 and 7. So that was like an hour, book on the shelf, down, done. And then they said, make a list of all the people you farmed. And the problem is I have a very good memory, and I've been a thief for a long time, and I've hurt a lot of people. And so that list was long. It was really long, and it was really clear that I had a lot to clean up. And I thought, I'm not doing any of this. But I don't think. And now, by that point, I was 4+ years in AA. And what did I have? My mom didn't think I was going to be an idiot every time I showed up. I had friends. I was keeping a girlfriend. I hadn't been beaten up in a long time. I had everything I came in to get, right? I walked in and I said, can you do these things for me? They said, do these things. I said, great, I'll do these things. And now I'm thinking, I don't know that I need this. It turns out, just for everyone, it turns out that a lot of people go through that same equation between 4 and 7 years. And it seems to be a mix, and it's not my experience, so I'm going to be, it seems to be a mix of things, which is, it's been a long time since you hit a bottom, right? It's a long time to really remember that pain. And so if I'm only in these rooms because of the terror of what I experienced 5 years ago, it gets harder to remember that. Also, AA is a pain in the butt. Got to go to a lot of meetings. You got to work with people. You got, like, it's a time-consuming thing. It also turns out chemo is not great too, but people do it if their life depend on it. You know what I mean? Like, lots of people do things that are, you know. And the third is, and I've been really clear about this, if I haven't worked all the way through the steps by that point and I'm not fully engaged in working with others and watching the lights come on and being involved and people joining with God, then I'm missing a whole part of the program, right? Like, and you hear this all the time. People are like, you know, the meetings suck. And I'm like, well, what are you trying to get out of? Like, you're like 5 years sober. Like, why are you going to meetings for things now? Like, and don't get me wrong, everyone has points where I run into meetings all the time. But like, day in and day out, years into this program, like, relying on the fellowship, like, no, that's where we go to connect with newcomers. That's where we go to try to help others. That's where, so for me, I got to those events and I was like, I think I'm all set. But here's the thing. I didn't actually tell anyone that. So I still had my sponsor and I was like, I'm gonna make a few of these, you know, so that it looks good. And so I had worked at the Ohio Department of Transportation and I had been a flagman and I had a rain suit as a flagman, you know, the guy on the road, like turning the sun. And I stole that flag suit. I stole that rain suit because it was a really nice rain suit. And it had ODOT on it. And so I'm talking to my sponsor about what amends I should start with. And he was like, what about that coat that I was wearing at the time? And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, that's not your coat. And I was like, well, I mean, I've had it for a while. And he was like, that's the state's coat. And when I was on the Ohio Department of Transportation crew, there was a guy on my crew. And he was fit and clean cut and, you know, organized, and he had lived a hard life before then. And he had found God, not through Alcoholics Anonymous, but he had found God and he had changed his life. And he ID'd me as a kid that was swirling the drink. And so every day he would be like, you know, Chandler, Jesus just loves you. And I'd be like, get away from me. And every, you know, we eat our lunch, I'd be under the tree, you know, like, eating, and I'm like pounding Milwaukee's Best after work and driving a 72 Ford Granada with no mufflers. And I'm like, this is fine. I'm done. I'm just going to do this life. And he would be like, you want to talk about God today, Chandler? I'm like, dude. And so I left that job. Got to make these amends. I grab the suit. And this is what I think, because I become like a not great AA member. And so what I think is I'm going to drive to the Ohio Department of Transportation Depot, and I'm going to heap this stuff over the fence. It's an amend, right? And so I drive up, and it's raining. And just as I pull up, the gate's closing. And I was like, ugh. And so the guy's like, he walks over and he leans in, and who is he? And I was like, hey, and this is years later, 3 years later. I was like, hey, and he was like, Chandler? And I was like, yeah, I got to return this suit, and I hate stuff. And he goes, Chandler, did you get sober? Oh my God, he was so excited. And I was like, I'm never doing another amend in my life. Like, I was like, run out. And what proceeded to kick off was me trying to manage my alcoholism, not drinking and not doing a rigorous course of action to build a relationship with God, which is what the steps are. And I went into about 4 years of pain and suffering that made my drinking years look like a cake. Because I have alcoholism. I have alcoholism, which is driven by a fatal level of selfishness, backed by character defects that make my life and everyone's life around me miserable. And if I'm not living away, if I'm not putting this design for living to grow my spiritual life, those character defects are not something I can control on my own. And I didn't understand that. And so what proceeded to kick off was me waking up every day saying, today I'm going to be a normal human being. And going to bed every night saying, tomorrow's a new day. And I'm never without a plan. I'm a man of action, and I'm never without a plan. And so I proceeded to put into place all kinds of plans. So one plan was, I will move all over the country, because the problem is clearly wherever it is I'm living right now. And the second plan was, I will get a girlfriend who will teach me how to live. And that didn't work at all. Not at all. And the third plan was, I'll try some sort of mix of therapy, Buddhism, diet, exercise, like, and all of those things are great as a compliment to that 11 steps. I'm not, but like, I played a game with therapists where I would be like, I bet I can make you cry. And I was good at it. And then I decided I would get a very expensive graduate degree, because education, employment, that would fix it. Now, it turns out what the story I have from basically years 4 through 9, I never left Alcoholics Anonymous. I never drank, and I never left Alcoholics Anonymous, because I knew there was something here, I just didn't think it was for me. I had this very big delusion about how God separated people into good people that he took care of and bad people that he crapped on, and I just happened to be on the crapped on side, so I just needed to like get by. That was sort of, and I kept that quiet until I hit another bottom in AA. My girlfriend, who had left me by that point, went out of town with another guy, and I found out. I was 7 years sober, and I found out that she went out of town by the guy explaining that to me over me from the passenger side, asking her where his sleeping bag was. And I thought, well, I'm going to kill them both. And I got out of my car, and I was hustling. I'm not armed right now, just so real quick. I own guns, and I carried guns sometime at that time, and if I had a gun on me at that time, we would be in a very different position. Because I was hustling home to get my gun to figure out which one of them I should kill first. Like, I knew where he was going to be. And there was like this slow clap in my head of like, look at yourself. Isn't this great? You are hustling home to get your gun to kill your ex-girlfriend. And I got to my house and I called my sponsor. And for some reason, I had a Big Book sponsor. And I was like, it was like 3:30 in the afternoon. And I was like, hey, I'm going to go kill my ex-girlfriend. And he was like at work. You know, he's like, yeah, okay, go to a meeting tonight. And I was like, because by that point, I was like the worst member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would never leave. I would duck into meetings when when everything was on fire. I had a sponsor, but it was from a different town. I had a home group that was in a different town. Like, I would share on stuff I wasn't doing. Like, I would share for a long time on stuff I wasn't doing. We all know these members of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And if anyone asked me what step I was on, I would say 11 because they didn't understand it either, right? Like, you want a real short conversation, Alcoholics Anonymous, about the steps, telling you well, what's going on with the 11 step? People would be like, well, and so like, but I would never leave. I would never leave. And one of the things that I know today is we don't shoot our wounded here. We don't shoot our wounded here. And so everyone would just smile and say, you're going to be all right someday if you keep trying to grow to God. That's what they would say. And I would say, I hate God. And art in my head, and I'd be like, yeah, praise God. Thank you. And so I called my sponsor. And I was like, I'm going to go kill someone. He said, don't, go to a meeting. And I said, I don't think you understand the gravity of this situation. And he said something that changed my life. And it's the little things. It is the little things. He was frustrated. And he said, what is it you think I'm going to say on this phone that's going to fix you? And I was like, man, I never really liked you. And he said the same thing everyone has said. He said, if you want to change, get your big book, meet me before the meeting. We'll start working through these steps like your life depends on it. If you don't want to change, go to a meeting and try not to shoot someone. And hung up on me. Now, we have extensively discussed whether he hung up on me, because I particularly remember the hanging up part. And he was like, I don't think I was. And so for me, that was the bottom. I hit a bottom, and the bottom that I hit was me walking home and knowing it was the first time, and I know this is a weird story, and I know it's hard to put it in context, because many people in Alcoholics Anonymous hit this kind of bottom with drink, and I get it, but I'm not the only one, and so that's why I share this. I hit a bottom, I hit a surrender in Alcoholics Anonymous to alcoholism 7 years sober, and it was because it was the first time I understood in my heart that this disease was going to kill me. That I was not in control. I was living ways that I didn't want to live, and I was trying really hard not to. And that is an experience many people have with drinking. So they try not to drink. I got sober young, and the biggest part of the first step was, and my life is unmanageable. That's the part I didn't get. That's the part I didn't get until it wasn't the drinking. It had nothing to do with the drinking. It had everything to do with my relationship with God, with who I am and what I'm showing up with. I'm homicidally jealous when I am not living a life. And it is hard to go through life successfully like that. And so I got with my sponsor. He also was 5'4". And we met. It was so awful. We met in the preschool room of the church. In the little tiny chair. It was brutal. It was brutal. They called us the Lilliputians. He's like, we have to be here. And he just like, show some willingness. And he walked me through and he said, are you alcoholic? I said, I went to rehab. And he said, that's not it. That's not it. And so we went through the doctor's opinion. And he said, do you believe in God? And I said, yeah. And he said, tell me about it. And I said, bro, there's things I don't want to say out loud. And he said, you don't have the luxury of those resentments. If you think you do, you don't understand the disease that you have. Because a drowning man does not question the color of the life preserver. And I was like, bro. And so I was like, this is what I believe about God. And he said, I have no idea how you've been sober 7 years. Like, I couldn't stay sober for a second on that. And for the record, that is not what I believe to be true. And I was like, I don't think this is ever going to change. And he said, the great news is no one cares what you think. And that's a huge message. And it's funny, but it's a huge message, right? Like, no one cares what you think. We care what you do. What you do changes you. It changes me, not what I think. And so I moved to Baltimore. And I moved to Baltimore. This is such a crazy story, and I want to be cutting off to it. I moved to Baltimore, Maryland, and I went to a really horrible meeting in North Baltimore, and I thought, I'm going to die of this disease in this city. And so I called, for the record, I'm still full of opinions, and I still hate that meeting. So just to be really clear. So I called my sponsor in Maine, and I was like, they don't do AA right here. And he was like, maybe you go to a few more meetings, and I was like, dude, I'm going to die. And he said, okay, well, look, if I need to sponsor you from here, I got it. Like, we'll figure it out. Like, we'll figure it out. And so he went to his home group in Rockland, Maryland. I mean, in Rockland, Maine. And he was sitting around talking to a guy about how his buddy was in Baltimore and AA sucked it. And he thought this guy, Maynard, was from North Carolina. But it turns out he got sober in Baltimore. And he said, tell your buddy he's full of crap. And Ryan was like, what? And he's like, Baltimore's safe for AA. And have him call these five people. And he rattled off five names. Now, I know all of those names. One was Tom F., Tom Flynn. I can use his full name because he's gone. One was Dave B., who has become my sponsor and has been my sponsor for 22 years. Chris E., who I go to meetings with today. And John C., who goes to meetings in South Oakland. And what I know about those men is that all of them can carry someone through the steps without even, you know, all of them are life preservers. And so I called Dave, and I ended up hooking up with Dave, and I was like, will you sponsor me? And Dave said, I could use a crazy guy like you right about now. That's a true story. I was like, hey, I'm like 9 years sober, completely insane. Like, cool, if you sponsor me? And he was like, yeah, we can do that. And he sat down with me, and he said, where are you with God? And I was like, I'm going to be honest, this is where I am. And he said, okay, here's the funny thing. I wouldn't take directions to the mall from you, but like, you're telling me stuff about what God is. And so he was like, let's be clear. There's two things in the world, you and God, and they're not the same thing. And then he said, if you want to build a relationship with God, why don't you wipe the slate clean and ask him to show himself? Now, I'm going to be very honest with you. Be very careful with that prayer. Because stuff's coming. And he said, I'll walk through the rest of the steps with you. Let's try to get you a relationship with God. And so I prayed, and I was like, hey, God, I hate you. I have no interest in a relationship with you. I started to be honest for the first time. I was like 9 years in AA despising God in a fellowship about growing a relationship with God. And I was not honest with anyone. I wasn't honest with myself. I wasn't honest with God. I wasn't honest with my spouse. I wasn't honest with anyone. And I started to be honest, and all kinds of things started to change. And so the biggest thing was I went through an inventory with Dave, and it was the first time. So I had done a bunch of inventories, and I want to be crystal clear. I think they were all important, and I think this is all a journey. And I think when the student's ready, the teacher comes, and I think people settle through spiritual growth levels in this program the longer you stay here. Like, it's always changing. And so this inventory was the first time that I knew what a character defect was. And so in the previous inventories, I had talked about awful things in my life. In this inventory, I talked about awful things in my life that I had been trying to change for 20 years and I hadn't made a dent on. And I went into a 6 and 7 for the first time, understanding exactly what I was asking God to do. Rich, poor, single, married, gay, straight, with kids, without, career. Like, I'm done in the, like, I'm telling you what I need business. I am in the, if you leave me alone by myself, I'm going to blow my brains out. And so can you take this and do whatever you want? Now, the flip is, it turns out it's a hedged bet, right? Because if you walk into a room like this and our job is to help people get sober, who wants to talk to the miserable SOB in the corner, right? Like, who wants to talk to the person that's like living life and engaged? And so when I say to God, like, hey, do whatever you want, what he said, what the message I get back is, happy, joyous, and free is what makes you most useful to me. So like, let's get you to a place where you can talk about what a relationship with God looks like. And I did that 6 and 7, and I went to God honestly. And the book, it's a weird thing in the fifth step, which I never sort of like, it was, it's like, it's the little things, and I get it, but like, it says admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. I admitted to me and to another human being I had never talked about any. And so when that 6 and 7, I went to him in that 6 and 7, in that hour, and I was like, here's the stock and trade that I am most ashamed of. Take it. It's all in. This is who I am, period. It's funny because, like, if there are, like, these things about God, which is that he's omnipresent, like, probably he knew anyway, but, like, me coughing it up was, like, and I was, like, I don't care what happens after this. You can take my life, and I'm good to go. And for the first time in my life, I had this feeling like everything was going to be okay. Like, everything was going to be okay. I did go on. There's other parts of my story which I don't like. This is one of them. I have hundreds of amends. I know people that come into AA and they get with their sponsor and they're through the steps of the week and they got like 6 amends and they burn through them in an afternoon and they're like, I'm done my amends. And I'm very jealous of that story. I don't doubt that story. I think that story is great. It's just not my story. And so I will probably be making amends for the rest of my sperm. Like, there are just a ton of amends, but I'll mention a couple of them that really started to show, that really started to show, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, the first 8 steps are done with us in the rooms, with you and your sponsor and God, but it's not done out there, right? It's in the 9th step where we go out to talk to people that aren't, and it's also where the book talks about 9 times out of 10 the unexpected happens. And in my view, it's actually the amends where I went from thinking God was involved in my life. Because the image that I had of God when I came in was, at best, it was offensive coordinator up in the booth, right? With like maybe an earpiece to me on the ground, but no real help, right? Like if the defense is blitzing and your O-line falls apart, that O-line coordinator does not get hit. Like he's up there, you know, they're up there, like far away looking down, right? And like for me, that was like, okay, so you're up there in this like throne thing and there's no room down here for you to help me. So I'm still kind of in the Mad Max Return to Thunderdome thing and I'm just trying to get through life. And it was in amends that God was like, no, dude, I'm here. Like I'm here. And one of the things that I did, because I'm not like, to the extent that I was praying, I was usually praying for like airstrikes on people or for people to die. Like I'll be like, hey God, can I get a parking spot today? No, you didn't give me a parking spot, you hate me. Fine. Hey God, that dude, can we kill that dude today? No? Okay, fine. You're not listening. And so I didn't really know what you could ask for. And so I pulled, and if anyone gives me your email, I'll send this to you. I pulled all the prayers to the book because I was like, I'm going to rely on what these knuckleheads who wrote this book in 35, what they thought you could ask from God. And it turns out it's all super amazing. Like you can ask for your fear to be removed. You can ask for your anger to be removed. You can ask for an intuitive thought or direction. None of which is like an offensive line coordinator up there that can't give you any help here. It is here. Like the help that we get from God, that I get from God today is here. It's on this ground. It's on this planet. It's in this room. And it's today. And I started to learn that through amends. So my dad passed away and he lived in Canada. And I had broken into a car in Canada. I was a criminal. And I stole a bunch of stuff. And one of the things that I stole was a pilot's log, which, right. So, like, if you know anything about pilot's logs, they're really important to the pilot. And so I stole a bunch of stuff, including the pilot's log, and I got home, and I was like, this is a pilot's log. This is bad. And so I went back to the guy, knocked on the door, I said, I found this. And he said, you found it, huh? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, where did you find it? Because there's some other stuff that's missing. And I was like, down in the field, and he was like, we taking that. So me and this guy are wandering around this field. And then he rewarded me. He gave me $20 for returning the thing I stole. I felt very badly about that. And it was like a serial killer. I kept trophies. So I kept his pilot's license. I had his pilot's license. And so like 20 years later, literally, my dad passes away. I end up in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And I'm like, I'm going to make this amend. And so I look through the phone book and there's like, it's Billy Foote. I still remember the guy's name. I look through this phone book and there's like 8 Billy Foots. And I just start calling them. I say, were you a pilot? And finally I get one that says, yeah, I was a pilot. And I said, Mr. Foote, I've gotten sober and I stole some stuff out of your car and I'd like to make amends. I said, do you remember losing your pilot's log? And he was like, yeah. I was like, shut up. And so I said, I have some additional things from that. I'd like to come with a ministry. Would you be open to that? He said, yeah, I think we could do that. And my cousin had flown in, and she was a lawyer. She's not an AA. And I was like, good chance I'm going to prison for a federal crime. So maybe just sit in the car while I cover this off. And she was like, I'm going in with you. And so we go in and I say, Mr. Foote, I'm Chandler Morris. And he says, I know who you are. And I said, what? And he said, you're Tom Morris's son. And I said, yeah, I am. He said, you guys used to live over there. And I said, yeah. And he said, what's this thing? And I said, sir, I actually stole that from you and I returned it. I feel terrible. And I've got these things that I need to return. And he pulls the same briefcase out from behind a chair and he said, why don't we make this full circle and why don't you put this back in yourself? And then he said, how's your family? And I said, sir, I'm in town because my dad's passed away. And he said, your dad must be very proud. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do most days in life, right? Like, and I know I was supposed to be in that living room on that day to hear that man say that my dad is proud. And that's the relationship I have with God today. That's what I came from was sharp stick, bad sense of humor, couldn't care less about me, and I hate him. And what I have today is I don't go to bed at night without, I lay my head on the pillow and I have a reassuring thank you for being around today, God. That's what I have. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And I'm bad at it. I don't go to enough meetings. I don't return sponsees calls fast enough. I swear in meetings. Like I'm bad at it. I drag my feet on amends. But the one thing that I do is I just show up all the time. I just show up all the time, all the time. And this program has a way of like, if we're willing to put some work into it, working. And I want to be crystal clear that I didn't think any of this was going to work. And when I took the third step with Dave Doss as my sponsor, ooh, Dave D, sorry. See, I'm really bad at this. When I took that third step, when I got to Baltimore, the truth is what I said was, I'm going to dot all the I's, I'm going to cross all the T's, I'm going to work this program like my life depends on it, and then I'm going to blow my brains out, and God, you and I are going to have a conversation when I get to the other side. That's, and all my higher power heard was like, yeah, I'm going to work this step. So I could go on for another while, but I'm going to stop there. Billy, thank you for asking me to come down. It's a pleasure. Thank you for the warm hospitality, and I look forward to the rest of the week.